And welcome to the Arts and Sciences lecture. My name is Greg Simpson. It's my pleasure to serve as the Dean of the College, and I thank you all for being here. For the students who are here, I would ask that you make sure that you stay for until all the questions are asked and answered, and if everyone would please check your cell phone to make sure that it is turned off. Being chosen by one's peers as the Arts and Sciences lecturer is the highest honor that the College of Arts and Sciences can bestow on its faculty. It's a peer-determined award that recognizes the significant national and international reputation of a scholar and teacher in the college, and can be bestowed upon a faculty member only once in his or her career. The Arts and Sciences Lecture Series was established in 1968 as a means of honoring scholars within the college, and it celebrates the crucial academic work of our faculty involved in expanding the knowledge base in their disciplines. In addition, this series is one way that the college fulfills its social responsibility to interact with the larger intellectual community within which we operate, publicly by engaging in the intellectual activities that we so value. This evening, Dr. Tim Dash, Distinguished Professor of Chemistry, will continue the tradition of the Arts and Sciences lecture. Dr. Craig McLaughlin, Interim Chair of the Department of Chemistry, will now introduce Professor Lash.
Thank you, Dean Simpson. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce my colleague, Distinguished Professor Timothy Lash, an organic chemist in my department. Tim earned his bachelor's degree from Exeter in the UK and his PhD from University College Cardiff in Wales. And Tim joined Illinois State in 1984 and achieved the rank of professor in 1993. He has earned many awards prior to tonight, including a Research Initiative Award in 1986, and he was selected for the College of Arts and Sciences Outstanding Research Award in 1993. He received the Outstanding University Researcher Award in 1995, and the ISU College of Arts and Sciences Dean's Award for Outstanding Scholarship in 2005. In 2000, he became an ISU Distinguished Professor. While at ISU, Tim has received more than 20 individual research grants worth approximately $2.4 million, with many of those from the National Science Foundation. Tim epitomizes the teacher-scholar model that we pride ourselves on in chemistry. More than 100 undergraduate students have worked on these projects with him, and over 50 master's graduate students have carried out research under his direction. Their work has resulted in 3 book chapters and nearly 180 papers in international research journals, at least 3 of which have appeared on the covers or frontispieces, which is quite impressive. The title of his talk tonight is Porphyrins, Nature's Rainbow Coalition. Ladies and gentlemen, Distinguished Professor Timothy D. Lash.
I don't want to talk at the microphone because it's sort of awkward. I like to walk around and... Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Now, I'll let you into a little bit of my background. About 3.5 years ago, I was operated on for late-stage oral cancer. And so my speech is not perfect. But as long as you can understand me, that's great. It's a great honor to be selected for this relationship. And it's also rather daunting, because I need to tell you about chemistry. Some of you will say, chemistry? I know when I talk to people and they ask me what I do, they often don't react well when I say, I'm a chemist. They sort of look at me and sort of try and be a voice as soon as possible. and so I'm going to try and make this palatable. And I am going to try and tell you a bit about chemistry, though, as we go along. Now, let's move on to the first slide. Now, a little over 20 years ago, I wrote a book chapter. And you know, chemists usually publish in journals. They don't publish in books. But I was asked to write this book chapter, and I was sort of pleased about this. I got my own copy, and my wife said to me, I have to give it to my mother, because she needs to be proud of me. And so, sadly, that was the last I saw of the book. Then it was sent off to England, where my mother is still living. And we went to visit a little while later. And she said how proud she was, and she pulled the book out. And so, when we got her sister visiting, and how she thought I was so clever. And then she said, it looks just like chicken wire. didn't understand anything else, but I was very clever. The rest of it was incomprehensible. Now, she's completely wrong about this, because chicken wire actually looks like a lot of benzene rims fused together. There's nothing about this. But my aim today is that you go away saying, this wasn't chicken wire. Right? So, all right. Now, I started taking chemistry classes when I was about 13 in Britain, and I liked chemistry, so I soon decided I wanted to be a chemist. And of course, people want to be viewed twice, which is a good thing. And one of the things they wanted me to do was take German. And at the age of 14, of course, I didn't listen to anyone, so I didn't take German. German was considered to be a language you needed to know as a chemist back in the 60s. Fortunately, today, nearly everything is published in English, so it's a move on my part. In Britain, though, when you say you want to be a chemist, a lot of people are a bit confused by this, because in Britain, a pharmacy is called a chemist. Now, the big change in Britain is boots. So it's Walmart here, but it's boots in Britain. So I did not want to work behind the counter of boots, which is basically what they thought I meant by this. But I didn't know this at the time, but my mother's father, my maternal grandfather, actually used to own a little shop. This was changed in 1925. I have a little point here. And this is an advertisement they had, where apparently sufferers from bilious and nervous disorders such as sick headache, indigestion, human ailments, liver complaints will find Spencer's pills the cure for their ills. And it goes on. Well, I don't want to be that sort of chemist. So I don't know who bought those pills, but I'm pretty confident they didn't do any of the things which are listed on the ad. Okay, I never do outlines for what I talk. But today I'm going to make an exception. What I'd like to do today is start off by saying a bit about the history of my area. And so, how do we know what we know? I'll tell you a bit about the Poor Friends, which I'm describing as the Rainbow Coalition of Nature. In order to tell you a little bit about the work I do, I'll have to explain what I mean by aromaticity. Aromaticity is not just smelling good, which is what it says there. But I'll also tell you about how we can make compounds of this type, and how we've also studied compounds which are not natural compounds, but which tell us more about nature's pigments. So that's the idea. So, a quote that's much beloved by porphyrin chemists, written by John Donne back in 1604, why grass is green and why our blood is red are mysteries which none have reached unto. Now, this does not have the ring of for whom the bell tolls or no man is an island. But it does make a philosophical statement, and that is, there are some things we're never going to understand. And the vibrant colours that we associate with blood and with green plants, we'll never know what that's about. But of course, a lot has changed in the past 400 years. Well, to understand any of that, we have to know what light is. Now, I'm not a physicist, so I'm not going to pretend I know much about this, but certainly during the 17th century, a lot of work was done on light. Newton, starting back in the 1660s, did a lot of work on light. He didn't just do gravity, light was a big interest of his. And amongst other things, he worked on these prisms and showed that light could be split into a spectrum. He also claimed that you could bring the spectrum back together again with a second prism to get white light. But the point here is that light consists of a rainbow of colours. He also believed that light consisted of a stream of particles. And that's something that was pretty much accepted for the next 100 years. At the same time, Newton has such a big impact on science in his day that a little tongue-in-cheek, Alexander Pope wrote the following eulogy. And it's a beautiful quote, isn't it? "Nature and nature's laws lay hidden light, but said, let Newton be, and all was right." Nevertheless, not everyone agreed with Newton, and Robert Hooke, who disliked Newton, proposed a completely different idea about what light was about. And he believed it was more like a ripple on a pond. And this was the first idea about light being a wave-type function. Now, today we know that they were both right, because light behaves like a stream of particles, which we call photons, and like waves. But what I want to say here is that we can consider light to be like a wave propagating through space. And it has a wavelength, and that's the space between crests. As the wavelength gets longer, the energy gets less. And that's what we need to know. Light can be split up into a spectrum which goes a lot further than the light we can see. And it stretches from radial waves all the way through to highly energetic X-rays and gamma rays. And so it's only a tiny little bit of the spectrum that corresponds to visible light. The lower energy and therefore longer wavelength side is red, and the higher energy side is blue. Okay, so that's light. Well, what makes something colored is the fact that it absorbs some light, but not other light. And so chlorophyll, which is the green color in plants, is green because it absorbs red light. And so it absorbs in the red, and what we see is the complementary color, which is green. So that's why plants are green. Now, that's fine and good, but I'm a chemist. I don't want to know about the physics. I want to know about the compounds which are responsible for what's happening. And so, I'd like to sort of point out some of the great moments in history. Now, we're talking about blood, that's red, and glass, that's green. And so, where can we start? Well, Mendini, way back in 1747, identified iron in blood, and specifically in red blood cells. Now, he did a very primitive experiment to figure this out. He heated blood, dried blood, at a high temperature, and then he brought out a magnet and showed the little particles of iron came from the magnet. That's how he did it. And, for those days, that was state-of-the-art chemistry. Moving forward into the 19th century, two French chemists, Camteau and Pelletier, actually one of them was an apothecary, isolated chlorophyll, that's a green stuff in plants. Now, the picture shown on the bottom there is actually supposed to be that. This is not contemporary, it was actually painted in the 20th century. But they had a little lab off of the apothecary. And basically, it was like working in a garden shed. But they figured out that solvents, that is, organic solutions, could be used to extract organic materials. And they were the first people to extract out and isolate chlorophyll. They decided to call it chlorophyll because the Greek word for green is chlorus, and the Greek word for leaf is phylum, so chlorophyll means green leaf. They didn't just isolate chlorophyll, they isolated a number of different compounds, including strychnine and caffeine. So they did a lot of other work besides this. And it was a start. In 1841, Scherer did an experiment where he took dried blood and he added sulfuric acid to it. And then he could extract this red-colored substance. that did not contain iron. We now know that the extracted porphyrin, which of course is what I'm interested in, didn't do anything with them. Later on, treatment isolated heme in pure form, and that's the red color of the blood. And Oppenzeller, a German chemist, named hemoglobin sometime later. In the 19th century, where all of this really got going, organic chemistry was very, very primitive. It was just at its very beginning. One of the very famous people of his day was Justus von Liebig, a German chemist. And this shows his laboratory circa 1842. I really like this photograph of this guest, because you have these guys in the lab, and then they are with tough hats on. Now, I don't believe that. I mean, I think they knew the sketch artist was turned by that day, and they put the best clothes on, because... But, Liebig was particularly renowned for developing methods for analyzing organic compounds. And he was really the first person to design methods which people could use. He was also the first person to design fume hoods. And organic chemists know that we don't want to do much chemistry without a fume hood. Now, Liebig did not do any work on the porphyrin, but many people went to his lab, and one of them, who spent a year working with him, was Ludwig Thürichum. Now, Ludwig Thürichum was actually trained in medicine. But he spent 1 year with Leibniz and learned his techniques. And he also picked up methods developed by Bunsen on spectroscopy, the very earliest form of spectroscopy, which is analyzing compounds with light. And he did a lot of remarkable things. He's often called the chemist of the brain, because he isolated compounds from brain, basically, lipids and things like that. He looked at gallstones. He even wrote a cookbook, which is true. But he was the first person, probably, to isolate a porphyrin. And again, he went back to that same experiment where he treated hemoglobin with sulfuric acid. He extracted the compound out and isolated it and characterized it with his spectrometer, such as it was. He called this compound parenthine, from the Latin word meaning blood red. Now, my knowledge of languages is not that great, but people in those days, they knew Greek and they knew Latin, and all these names come from classical languages. His samples actually still exist, and this is taken from a book, but that's not working, but you can see his samples down there, with his handwriting actually legible. So it's interesting that those samples still exist today. Shortly thereafter, Oppenzeller did the same thing, basically. He isolated the same compound, but he claimed precedence for this. And he renamed the compound hematoporphyrin, from the Greek words for blood and purple. And that's because the porphyrin that's isolated is actually a purple color. And most porphyrins are purple. That's my shirt, by the way. That's a porphyrin. Now, this actually turned a bit nasty because Oppenzeller described Thürichum's work as being patently spurious or falsified. Not very nice. Now, there's no doubt that Thürichum had isolated hematoporphyrin. Oppenzeller had worked on hemoglobin for years, and he continued to do later on, and he made a lot of contributions. But, and this was unfortunate. David Framkin, who wrote his autobiography, I'm sorry, his biography, says at the end of this paragraph, Oppenzeller was a purer in his area of hemoglobin, and it pleased him to have their papers begin and end with an implied higher hop. Well, I think that probably is going a bit overboard, but there was clearly a lot of bad blood between these two great pieces. Now, it takes quite a while to make that. and that's not an easy conversation to make. But we can make it in a reasonable point of view, so it teaches students occupied and not to make it. And then we take this by ally. This is a beautiful piece where it's your ally pizza. You can imagine taking all these different pieces and plopping them in. And over a lot of years, we've been able to do exactly that and make a lot of porphyrin-like compounds. The first one that we looked at, and another German group actually looked at this at around the same time, was with benzene. So you have a benzene slotted in. And the question then is it like a porphyrin? Well, no. It really isn't. Only the other thing on the bottom. It doesn't have that pathway that's like ancient anion. And so it's not like a porphyrin. And we can tell from the NMR spectrum. Because we said the inside hydrogen should be way over there, and the outside hydrogen should be way over there. So they all show up in the middle. That's what these are. And so, actually, it's nothing like a porphyrin. It's interesting, it's an interesting property. And the way it absorbs light is also different too. It doesn't look like a porphyrin. But this was the idea I had at the time. Maybe if I had an OH to that. Now that OH is just an alcohol unit, or a phenol unit in this particular case. Maybe that would change things. Because it would give it an opportunity to rearrange. And if you could take that hydrogen, which is way up there, and you could bring it down onto the nitrogen, you could form a carbon oxygen double bond. And you'd have something like a porphyrin. Now, bear in mind this is the same experiment with one tiny, tiny change. Well, now, that's too complicated, but the inside hydrogen is now at minus 7.2. That's a shift of 15 on the scale, 15 parts per million. And usually when students who are here who've done NMR know that everything shows up within a window of about 10 units, 10 parts per million. So if something shifts by 15, that's amazing, right? That's a huge effect. So the inside is over there, and the outside is over there, and it's just like a porphyrin. And so, very nice proof of concept. Of course, a true carbon porphyrin would have a 5-number ring, not a 6-number ring. We found the easiest way to do that one was to have a benzene ring as well. And this, the reason we did that was we could make the intermediate. It's very easy to make that compound, and that's why we did it this way. But again, just like a porphyrin. This is a carbon porphyrin, it's just like a porphyrin. You can react it with acid, but we don't need to go into that. And the NMR says, yay, minus 7 plus 10, big aromatic effect. I always tell Greg when he does an X-ray for me that it's a pretty picture. And he says, bum, bum, bum. But basically, this is a picture of a carbon porphyrin X-ray crystallography, and you can tell by looking at it, looking at the bond lengths and things like that, it's very, very like a porphyrin. And so the two pictures are the same compound. It wasn't actually planar, not as flat as it might be. We actually made the same sort of compound with a chlorine attached. And chlorines are big. That's the main thing to know about a chlorine. And so it causes it to really twist out of shape. It's not flat anymore. Now, usually we expect an aromatic compound to be plain. That's, I didn't tell you that, but we expect it to be flat. It's still aromatic. It really makes very little difference to this compound that it's not planar. And that's interesting, because it tells us more about what these compounds are about. We've done chemistry on this system, and we found that they do a lot of interesting things. I won't tell you a lot about them. But we wanted to put metals into the middle of these structures because heme has iron, and purple has magnesium, and B12 has cobalt and so on. So let's put an iron in here, the student said. And I said, well, I don't think that's going to work for reasons I won't go into. We did the experiment, and he believed in that. Officer Arnold, though, did deserve a lot of credit because He continued to work in this area, and amongst other things, he showed that parcel and hymn are structurally related. And that's a very important thing. So not only is brass green and blood is red, but it's for a similar reason. The compounds that they contain are related to one another. We should also notice that they both had done the same experiment as Schiller had done a long time earlier. So, you know, that puts it in context. It wasn't until 1912 that Pfister figured out where porphyrin was. And he published this, and it's that picture, my pointer board's now, it's this picture up at the top here. That's a porphyrin, that's him. Actually, when you isolate him, it's often in an oxidized form, and there's a fluorine attached to it right there to denote it's arm-free for the chemist in the room. But essentially, this is the same as that. That's the modern way of doing the compound. Now, when he published this, nobody believed it. That's probably an exaggeration, but it wasn't accepted. And another chemist, Bill Satter, came up with an alternative proposal. It was completely wrong, but it was accepted by everybody. So, Bill Satter, though, to be fair, did a lot of great work. And he worked on the chlorophylls, in part. He was the first person to show there were two chlorophylls in higher parts and not one, for instance. And isolated chlorophyll A, which is the main pigment, from Fox. He won the Nobel Prize, deservedly, in 1915. Bill Satter is a sad case because he worked in Berlin, and he was Jewish. Very bad time to be practicing in Germany, and he was forced into early retirement at the age of 53 because he was Jewish. But he did some marvelous chemistry in his time, and my machine's not working. All right. The father of modern porphyrin chemistry was Hans Fischer, who worked at Munich. And he's the first person to actually make porphyrin. He also did the total synthesis of heme. Now, what that means is you start off with simple chemicals, and in a number of steps you put it together and you make an actual compound. He did that in 1929 and won the Nobel Prize for this work the following year. And it was groundbreaking work. Importantly, though, it proved Pfister was right. And so Pfister didn't get much out of it to start off with, but he was correct in his identification. Well, quickly following up on that, a lot of things have been discovered subsequently. In the 1930s, for instance, tribes found porphyrin in petroleum and other organic sediments, such as oil shells. These compounds were actually derived from hemes and chlorophylls, and they pretty much say fossil fuels derived from living things, sediments which were laid down millions of years ago. Patrick Linstead, discovered the structure of thalassines. That's that structure at the bottom, since this is not working too well. Thalassines are very important compounds, and they've been made by accident in industry. They tend to be blue colours or green colours, and they have a structure that's very, very similar to a porphyrin. The only real difference is they're connected by nitrogens instead of connected by carbons. To give you an idea of how important these compounds are, every year about 80,000 tonnes of thalassines are produced globally, valued at about $1 billion. So these are very important pigments that are used in the industry, and they're used primarily in things like paint, plastics. They're used in other things. You can dye fabrics with thalassines. They're even found in some cosmetics. I'm not sure what they're used for in cosmetics, but they are found there. And they do have some more modern uses as well. Fischer proposed the correct structure for chlorophyll in 1940, and subsequent to that, people went into something called X-ray crystallography. This is a way of actually seeing the structure of organic molecules. Hodgkin determined the structure of vitamin B12, which is a relative of the porphyrin, very much more complicated structure than. She won the Nobel Prize in 1954. Henry and Perutz, Max Perutz, won the Nobel Prize in 1962 for their figuring out the structures of myoglobin and hemoglobin. And these are much more complex structures because they contain all the protein structures as well. And you can see down the bottom, Max Perutz putting together a model of hemoglobin, which is where you found that from. Finally, being this much more up to date, Robert Burns Woodward, was one of the most famous organic chemists of the 20th century. And he synthesized a number of natural compounds. One of his most renowned synthesis, though, is the synthesis of chlorophyll. And he had an army of people, he had 15 postdoctoral associates who worked on this project. And eventually he came up with this compound, which is chlorophyll. He won the Nobel Prize too, but not just for chlorophyll. Around the same time, Bruce McDonald, who was a Canadian chemist, came up with a more general way of making porphyrins, based on the same idea, but independent. Woodward and Eskimos are subsequently made vitamin B12. The vitamin B12 was the Mount Everest of syntheses for its day. Okay, well, so people have been interested in porphyrins for a very long time. Nature apparently has decided that von Rehm will rule the world because porphyrins are used for so many purposes. Heme is a fourth band in hemoglobin and is responsible for oxygen transportation. It's found in many, many proteins. And it acts as a factor in enzymes that carry out peroxide destruction, for instance. It's found in cytochromes, which are responsible for transporting electrons, which are very important to chemical processes. So hugely important, life would not be possible without heme. And nor would it be possible without chlorophylls, because chlorophylls, which are found in plants and algae and photosynthetic bacteria, are responsible for photosynthesis. And without harnessing sunlight, where would we be? Because everything, all the food we eat, comes indirectly from sunlight. Of course, they're a bit more complicated than that. This shows a picture of hemoglobin. The ribbons of protein, they're not coloured, from the way the picture shows them, but there are four protein units and four hemes associated with the structure. Hemoglobin is pretty complicated. It's nothing compared to photosynthesis, though. I only drew a photo cartoon up for this one, because it's an immensely complicated chemical process. Sunlight is harnessed, you can put water and carbon dioxide into oxygen, and reactive chemicals, ATP and AGPH. They then act on carbon dioxide to produce carbohydrates. Well, okay, a broad oversimplification. This is just a tiny bit of the photosynthetic apparatus. This is the light harvesting array for a photosynthetic bacterium. Nine chlorophylls embedded in a protein matrix. There's also other pigments, such as pyrethroid pigments, present in this structure as well. And that's just the down of the sunlight. And so, yeah, life really loves porphyrins and certainly makes producible. This is the Rainbow Coalition. Some people call this the pigments of light. Heme is based on the porphyrin structure, which is on the bottom. If you reduce one of those double bonds, you have a product, and that's what we have in chlorophyll. Some bacteria go further and reduce two double bonds, and we have a bacteriophore. They do this so they can gather sunlight further into the red. And so, basically, they're more efficient by being able to produce these chlorophylls. Feynman's fault. Well, Feynman's fault is closely related to the pulpit. It's modified, and I won't go into how it's modified, it's apparent. But both in terms of the way it forms in nature by synthesis, and in terms of chemistry, it's related to the pulpit. Notice that helium contains iron, and chlorophyll contains magnesium. It's called cobalt. Every 120 days of that, our red blood cells are broken down. And in the process, we destroy the helium. Seems wasteful, but that's what happens. And we produce biofilms, there's oxygen involved. Initially, we form this blue green colored compound, bilirubin. And that's then reduced to bilirubin. Bilirubin is found in nature as a colorant. And for one thing, the blue color you see in certain bird eggs is bilirubin. Bilirubin is a toxic compound. It's actually a neurotoxin. So it's insane that we produce it in our bodies, but we do. But we get rid of it pretty quickly. If you bruise yourself, the color you see from bruising, that's bilirubin. And in jaundice, that's the same color, it's bilirubin there as well. So there's that. Bacteria use a lot of different porphyrin type compounds besides. Xylohim is involved in reduction of nitrites and sulfites. And it contains this isobacterial colon, I can't find. And this related compound, HemD1, does some similar things. The yellow colored compound is factor F430. That's found in primitive bacteria, the archaea, and it's actually responsible for methane formation. I don't know if you care about that particularly, but you know, nature does a lot of different things, and there's an intimate web of interconnectivity. Porphyrins play a role at many, many different levels. So there's lots of reasons to study porphyrins. They do lots of things in nature. If you understand how they're produced in nature, that can have uses too. There are diseases of porphyrin metabolism called porphyrias. And if we know how porphyrins are formed, we can better treat these diseases. I'd like to tell you more about that because there's an interesting story, but there won't be time. Porphyrins, we believe, were there from the very beginning, and studies on the origins of life definitely the porphyrins. There were medical applications, and in particular, porphyrins are used in a type of tumour therapy, unfortunately not the type of cancer that I had, but where used light to activate the porphyrin and destroy the tumour. They're found in petroleum, and you can use an analysis of porphyrins to learn about where the petroleum came from. You can use it in a prospecting sense. We can understand better how petroleum was formed in the first place. And it does have some environmental possibilities as well, in terms of tracking oil spills. Industrial pigments, porphyrin catalysts are out there. There's so many different things, and no time to tell you about that. I do want to tell you though about aromaticity. Porphyrins are aromatic compounds. What? Well, back in the early 19th century, Michael Faraday, who's best remembered today as a physicist, but he was really a chemist, isolated a compound which he called bicarbonate of hydrogen, which we now call benzene. And it's weird. It's a weird compound because it has a very low ratio of hydrogen to carbon. The ratio is 1:1. Now when you have low ratios of hydrogen, it usually means you have double bonds or triple bonds. And those are very reactive. They're very reactive compounds. And they have particular chemistry. Benzene is very stable, very unreactive, doesn't behave like it has double bonds. And people just did not understand that. Now, to be fair, they didn't understand very much in 1825. They certainly didn't know how to draw a structure. In the 1850s, Hoffman decided these compounds were aromatic. he noticed that benzene containing compounds were found in spices and in resins with nice odors, right? So they're aromatic, they smell nice. Now the truth is that some aromatic compounds don't have any odor at all. And some of them smell as bad as you can imagine anything to smell. And so it's got nothing to do with the odors, but that's where the name came from. Tetralite, in 1865, came up with an idea of what the structure was. And his basic idea was that it was a hexagon. Now, the original structure, I'm going to point with this, my finger, okay. That's his original structure. Six sausages stacked on top of each other. Now, I think he meant that this is connected to that, right? That's what the arrows mean. So that's the original representation. Very quickly, though, they came up with this version. And it's been, the sausages have now been stacked up. Now, in later life, he claimed that he actually came up with this idea when he was dozing in his study. And he had this idea that there was this chain of carbon atoms which all of a sudden did its own tail and formed a ring. And, you know, this is how primitive things work. They didn't know you could have rings. And this was part of his inspiration. Now, the truth of this story is this is what he said. Whether he actually came up with the idea that way has been debated. We now know, though, that he's basically right. People didn't believe it to start off with because the structure he was writing has double bonds in it. But we now know that the electrons are sort of smeared out. And that smearing out is what we call aromaticity. And we have certain types of electrons which are called pi electrons, and it's these electrons which are spread out over the ring. Well, people wondered, we see this in organic too. And there's one of my organic students here like that. By the way, the other students here got extra credit for being here. But people wondered, could a four-membered ring like benzene's a hexagon in the middle, be like benzene? Well, how about an eight-membered ring? Well, it took a long time to get to grips with this because they were very hard compounds to make. Wolfsadler, and that's the same Wolfsadler we talked about before, made cyclooctatetraene, the eight-membered ring. It took him 11 or 12 steps, and he made it from a nitrogen-containing compound being isolated from the bark of a pomegranate tree. So we went to great lengths to actually make this compound. And when he made it, it was nothing like benzene. And so people said, no, you didn't. You say you made it, but you didn't make it. He had made it, at least we believe he had. And certainly, it's nothing like benzene. A four-membered ring is about as bad as it gets. It's about the most unstable compound there is. And benzene, remember, really stable. Well, physical chemists came in and sort of looked at the problem. And didn't really say it exactly this way, but it came down to you have to have the right number of electrons for it to work. And the right number of electrons is, we say 4n plus 2, where n is a whole number, but it's 6, or 10, or 14, or 18, or something like that. This was sort of supported when Sontheimer made 18 aniline. That's the fish structure over there. It's got the right number of electrons and it's aromatic. It behaves like benzene, at least a bit. Now this is a porphyrin, this is our benzene. And the four lines you see there trace a ring like 18 aniline. It's sort of squished in so it looks a bit different. But I believe, that a lot of the aromatic character of a porphyrin derives from that pathway. One more thing here. I hate to have to do this here, if you're not a chemist, but modern organic chemists use a technique called nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. NMR for sure. Now, this is done in a magnetic field, so you have a big magnet to make this work. And in a magnetic field, the electrons are caused to circulate, and that gives an effect. Now, you get a lot of structural information from that picture on the bottom. Don't worry, you don't have to understand it. But the effect of this circulation of electrons is it produces its own magnetic field. And that causes anything that's in the middle to be shifted to higher magnetic field, and anything that's on the outside to be shifted to lower magnetic field. So we can actually measure aromaticity with this technique. And basically what it comes down to is one is shifted all the way over here, and the other one is shifted all the way over there. Right. So we can use that, and I will do as we go along. Photons also have a spectrum that's very characteristic. Now, we talked about visible light, and this is what we're talking about here. We look at the ultraviolet, that's just off to the side, and the visible region. And this is how the light is absorbed. So we have a lot of absorption here, that sits right on the ultraviolet. And then some smaller peaks further down. If we have something that's like a porphyrin, it's likely to look like this. The band that we see at 400 nanometers is called the Soray band. And it was first seen by a Swiss chemist called Jacques-Louis Soray back in the 1880s. And you've got to remember, it's ultraviolet, you can't see it. It is a photographic film, presumably, to actually pick it up. Alright, so, porphyrins are aro compounds. They're very stable. And we believe that they're aromatic because of that 18-pi-electron pathway. And basically the middle picture just shows the pathway on its own. So it's pretty much the same as 18-aniline with a couple of nitrogens stuck in it. Well, we believe that, and some other people believe it, but a lot of the theoretical chemists say, oh no, it isn't. And they believe that, in fact, this has little to do with the aromatic properties of the porphyrin. Now, one of them, a very famous chemist called Slade, he's in his 80s now, but he's still going strong, he still publishes a dozen papers a year, claims that actually it's a 22-pi-electron system. And basically what he's saying is, we ignore these two nitrogens. But you can't, he says. They're part of it. They're part of what makes it what it is. So we're wrong. And he based this on theory, and he did some bond lengths, which is what the numbers are, they just how long the bonds are. And he's so famous, he must be right. So we said, okay, let's not argue about it, let's make it with no nitrogens at those positions. So what we thought was, maybe we could remove those two nitrogens. And if it's like a porphyrin, we win. And if it's not like a porphyrin, he wins, right? So, the idea, the plan was, we could do that by combining two of the same molecule and forming a big ring. Well, okay, so we did that. And that just shows you the steps, but it was actually not that hard to do. We have this reaction called the McMurray reaction, which we can combine the two components. And the yields actually weren't too bad. We had a 28% yield. That's our best yield, but yeah, not too bad. And we could isolate it, and then we could look at it and say, is it like a porphyrin? Well, we looked at the way it absorbs light, the UV visible spectrum. The red line shows the original compound. If you add acid to it, the acid adds protons, H pluses, and you form what we call a dipala. Well, it looks a bit like a porphyrin to start off with. You have a Soray band. But when you add the acid, wow, it looks exactly like a porphyrin. So, that made us happy. Now, this is the NMR spectrum, but don't worry, all we have to know is the way over there, minus 2.5, that means it's really over there. We have the inside hydrogen. That's up to, that's a, the high-magnetic field, and the outside hydrogen, the pet. So, yeah, it's all right. When you add acid to it, even more so, Now we've got 11 on the one hand and 25.5 on the other hand. It's very, very aromatic. Now, Greg Kearns, who loves X-ray crystallography and helps us out a lot of the time, came up with this for us. This is a crystal that we brew, and it looks a lot like a porphyrin. The bromates are reasonably close to a porphyrin. So, we win, right? Well, the theoreticians say, no, you're still wrong. And I think the truth is actually in between. It's not as simple as we'd like to tell you. We always knew that. So the theoreticians do have a point. But we're not completely wrong either, and this says that. Well, one of the things we wanted to do was to say, well, let's get rid of those pesky nitrogens altogether. And, in fact, this is something I've been working on for a long time. Now, the original idea that I had was, maybe we could make this. It's porphyrin, but no nitrogen, right? It's got carbon atoms instead. We refer to this sort of thing as a carboporphyrin. They're not found in nature, so that's why it's going against nature. But by comparing it to natural compounds, we learn things. Now, originally we thought, well, you can take this five-membered uranium, add base, form an anion, react that with dipolar methane to form a bridge. Now, if you just do that again, we have this part. And then, just oxidize it, and we have what we call passerine. It's very sad, because it doesn't work. So what's the backup plan? Well, the backup plan is, let's replace one nitrogen at a time. So let's make it with one carbon, two carbons, three carbons, or four. Well, the truth is, we've only done it with one and two. And, yeah, maybe one day we'll get three or four, but we haven't been able to do that yet. But I'm not going to tell you about the one. In fact, I'm not going to tell you about the two at all. But they're really interesting. And before I tell you what we did, though, one of my students, and this is pretty recently, is there now? Oh, there he is. He says to me, we can do it on the computer. You don't need to make these compounds, you can do it on the computer. I said, well, you know, I don't believe the computer. But, and you know, in reality, you have to be careful. So you can do things on a computer, and you can do some very good things on a computer, but it's not a substitute. You really need to know what it's really like. But this is some of the pictures he came up with, and these are the shapes of the molecule. You can see they're not completely flat, but you can see what pattern looks like. We've never been able to make it, but there it is on a computer. And it's completely plain. Well, you can also get all sorts of information from the computer. Bond length, bond angles, molecular orbitals, which are these funny things at the bottom. Lots and lots of information. Paper. This is it. It's worth the publication, and we're waiting on tenterhooks to find out whether they say good for you or. But this is my first love, is really making these compounds. So, how do you make compounds? Well, we don't need to be technical about it. So, imagine you have a jigsaw puzzle with four pieces. Right? It's an easy puzzle. But porphyrins are made up of these individual rings. They're known as terols. But basically, all we have to do is put four of them together, and you have a porphyrin. It's not that easy. Sometimes it takes us years to make one of these compounds. And, but, you know, you can imagine. Four white pieces made a porphyrin. We'll put a red piece in instead, and now we've got not a porphyrin, but a red something. Or we put two red pieces in, or maybe a green piece and a red piece. And so, basically, that's the sort of idea we have. Now, we've developed a method for doing this, which we call our 3+1 methodology. So basically, we make this compound with three of these two rings. And Then we add in the food an hour later, it's done. It actually made things better. Don't often say that, but it was better because what it made was this green compound over here. And the colors are supposed to reflect the colors of this compound. We have two oxygens attached to the inside carbon atom. Amazing. 90% yield of this green color compound. Very polar, it's still aromatic, and it forms very, very easily. Selectivity, unusual chemistry, that's what we're interested in. You've heard about metals in the middle. Silver goes in very nicely. Hg is silver, for those of you who know chemistry. It's an unusual oxidation state, though. That's silver 3. And this happens spontaneously at room temperature. It disappears and becomes that compound. Here's one of Gray's X-rays. It's black. The silver rules it all together and makes it plain. This one I like. I don't know if anybody will appreciate it, but we began to put a carbon group on the nitrogen. And then for another, this time palladium. What happened in this reaction was the carbon grouping, the metal group, sticks from the nitrogen onto the carbon. That is a very interesting observation. And organic chemistry is all about making carbon-carbon bonds. That's the big thing for us. And we have actually made a carbon-carbon bond in the process. So a very unique reaction. The next several slides are not my work. I'm going to be very straightforward on that. But I have two colleagues in the department, Marge Jones and David Cedenia, who've been very interested in a disease called leishmaniasis. This is caused by a protozoan parasite, leishmania, which infects human beings and other animals. It's very widespread. This just shows you where it's found in the world. Not found in this country, and not found in most affluent countries. And so it's one of those diseases that the pharmaceutical companies don't care much about, because they don't make a profit out of it. This shows the life cycle for leishmania. Essentially, the sandfly, such blood, infects you, much the same way as a mosquito transmits malaria. And of course, it goes through a complicated life cycle, which I'm not going to tell you about, because maybe one of those will give one of these talks one of these days, and they can tell you more detail. But essentially, the parasite is from the bite, and of course, then next time a fly bites you, you reinfect them, and so it spreads. Cutaneous leishmaniasis is the most common form, that's in the skin, and extreme cases are really horrible, as the pictures show. In visceral leishmaniasis, the parasites migrate into the vital organs, particularly the liver and the spleen. And that's where it can be deadly. It causes 60,000 deaths annually, so the CDC website says. Interestingly, this mania don't form their own heme, they actually take it from their host. Well, methods used today to treat this leishmaniasis include the use of pentavalent antimony compound. Now, that's hugely toxic. So, it may work, it may not work. Parasites are actually becoming resistant to these compounds, but it's pretty sad to use that sort of agent. Amphotericin B is something that's used to treat it, but it's also very toxic, and so it's far from perfect. Well, they've looked at some of my compounds. That's my contribution. And one of the ones they've looked at is that green colored compound we just thought about, the carbon-porphyrin ketone. It's a pretty polar compound because it's isolated in a protonated form. It also has absorption in. That's the far left, so it's going off the edge of the visible region. And compounds with absorptions in that region often show a photodynamic effect. What that means is light makes them more active. And so they test this compound, it's actually pretty active. This slide isn't very good, and I apologize for it, but what it basically says is with one micromolar, you affect the growth rate. With two micromolar, it's slower, The fourth and tin micromolar is dead. You've killed the parasite. The other graph says, well, let's go back to 1.1 micromolar and look at it with light and without light. Now, I think they only exposed it about 2 hours a day for this particular study. And in the presence of light, it's telling it, growth is cut off. And so this compound is pretty active against this melanin. Whether it's, in a couple of papers to come out of that, whether another variant where it's available. But some of the other porphyrin compounds have also been tested and showing some promise. But so it's a bit tiny. We've made a lot of porphyrins by this method, and this shows some examples of some of the structural variety that we've been able to produce. But time does not permit me to say much about it. Now, polymer porphyrins of the type I've shown you have not been shown to have many applications as yet. This is very new, yeah. A group led by Chris Deaver have shown that cobalt polymer porphyrins have catalytic activity, neatly performing three-membered rings. Benzoporphyrins have also been shown to act as fluorescent sensors, the zinc panel. So there are some possibilities out there. I think more will come as time goes by. Well, I know time's moving along, so I want to very quickly tell you, about 5 minutes, about confused porphyrins. Now, in the 1930s, a chemist called Grossman came up with a very simple way of making porphyrins. And we actually do this, some semesters at least, in our organic lab. You take an aldehyde, you take chlor, you react them together, and they produce porphyrin. It's magic. And porphyrins do form very easily if you don't care about it's completely symmetrical. If you want any asymmetry, that's another story. So about 60 years later, two groups, and exactly the same time, independently found that they got a second product. And it's this one. Instead of having the nitrogen on the inside, it's on the outside. The Japanese group, Perugia's group, decided that the nitrogen was confused. It was supposed to be on the inside, and it's on the outside. And so they call them N-confused porphyrins. And believe it or not, everyone calls them N-confused porphyrins, or NCPs. And they've published reviews on the confusion approach to porphyroid chemistry, which is just ridiculous, but it's sort of nice to do. We've actually done a bit of this. There have been hundreds of papers published on this, literally hundreds of papers. We've published a couple. They're very interesting compounds. For instance, you can put nickel into the middle of this compound just by heating it up with nickel acid. And forming a carbon metal bond is not always an easy thing to do, so that's exciting. It's not an aromatic compound, but interestingly, you can switch on the aromaticity by just adding acid. You add acid, it adds an H plus on, and it becomes an aromatic compound. Well, that's not really what I want to tell you. We thought, well, the porphyrin has a nitrogen on the inside, and the N-confused porphyrin has it on the outside. So what if it was in between, and actually forms a bridge to the carbon? Well, these are two of Dad's pictures of the X-ray, not the X-ray, but the computation thing. But, you know, would that be like porphyrin? Well, the Greek word for new is neo, so it's a new confused porphyrin, new confusion. Well, we came up with a way of doing this, and we won't go through how we made it, but it's shown in the stand. The hard thing was making the precursor. But we made this compound, and there it is over here. We made it with a benzene ring fused to it, and there were reasons why we did that, but we were able to make a system, and we said, well, is it like a porphyrin? Does it have a spectrum like a porphyrin? And it's got a sorority band, it's got this smaller band, which is called Q bands, and yes it is. It looks, I mean, if I didn't know better, I'd say, hey, that's a porphyrin. The NMR spectrum shows signals off around the 0 to minus 1 region, and then signals over here in the 9 to 10 region. Now, they're not as big an effect as a porphyrin shows, but it's still pretty big, so it's aromatic, Tesla. We even have to put metals into it, like copper, nickel, palladium. And here's the next way to say, there's a nickel, there's a tip in the rubber. After we did that, I had another student, Bertie, who loved taking pictures of his columns. I've got some pictures of his columns in. And what he did was he made the compounds without the benzene ring, so we had a true nearly to the porphyry. Now when you first do the reaction, you don't have a double bond here. And so the initial form of compound, which we call the fluorine, is blue. And here you can see it, it's blue. Very pretty. Now if you oxidize it for 5 minutes, it's not brown. And what you see is, it's still a blue, but then you have this purple color, the box. And if you do it for 20 minutes, you just have a purple. So we can make those compounds, it's pretty straightforward. And they're very new and we're very excited about it. Some of you might say though, wait a minute, what's that green thing? And Roche said that and said, I'm going to isolate it. And you know, some of my students would have said, it's not what we wanted, be anyway. We spent a lot of time on this, and it wasn't easy to isolate and purify. We did it. And we had an NMR spectrum, which is how we tell what compounds are. And we said, I have no idea. We had half an idea, but it was pretty hard. Fortunately, Brave was able to get us this X-ray structure. And it's a very unusual compound. In fact, we have 6 of these subunits, 2 of them are sort of dangling off the side. It's a very, very new type of compound. We understand how it's been happened, so we actually do have an understanding of this. But it's way too complicated to tell you about today. The things come out of the chemistry, and this is the point, lots of interesting things about it. We've made complexes, nickel and palladium complexes, and here's the X-ray to prove the point. Now, getting these X-ray structures is not trivial, because more often than not, they just don't crystallize the right way. If you don't have good crystals, you can't get this sort of data. But when we get it, we say, wow, isn't it pretty? Nice, pretty picture. We're done. Corporans are really important compounds. They're ubiquitous in nature, as the slide says. And hopefully I've got some of that across to you today. Looking at corporans is important, but I think studying related compounds also has its importance. And over the last many years, carbon corporan type structures have become very, very important. They show very individual membrane character, they have interesting chemistry, and we've even found they're active in the treatment of dysmaniasis. We've found a new type of porphyrin isomer. An isomer is a compound that contains the same number of carbons and other elements as something else. Porphyrin isomers have attracted a lot of interest themselves, and are new to these porphyrins. I think we've just got started with that and we've found out a lot of new and interesting stuff about them in the future. Well, porphyrins are found everywhere, and as you can see in the slide, they're found in all sorts of strange places. My dog Stupid on the side is found in porphyrins. I wanted to thank a few people. First and foremost, my wife Susan, who's here in front. Who's put up with me for the last 33 years, and I really wouldn't have been able to do everything that I've done without her support. So certainly deserve thanks. Didn't know I was going to say it though. And of course I need to thank my students. I know one of my students, Leah, is over there, said don't put that photograph up. Three of the photographs are actually from the last 2 years of my group has slowly mutated. And the other picture is from a few years back in Chicago, where I had a more impressive sized group of students. This is over the last 25 years, where so many different students have worked with me, and I'm certainly pleased to have had them. And this just shows some recent students who've given posters at national meetings, and I do encourage that. And thank goodness my department encourages it too, because Kevin Father found money to help us do this sort of thing. But here they are saying, some very impressive posters at national meetings. I also have to thank people who gave us money, and in particular the National Science Foundation, who've given us a bulk of our money, but also the Petroleum Research Fund, who really helped us get started, because they do support the Ian family, and actually I still have funding from them today, and others. I'll mention just a few families who've helped me out. Greg for the many x-ray structures that he's determined for us. Liz Sepuris does some electrochemistry for us. Joe Tredanius does some further physical studies on our compounds. And also, with Morris Jones and some collaborators elsewhere, have done all this work with this many issues. Morris also has worked with me on the healing biosynthetic pathway, how humus is produced in our bodies. And that's not something we're currently working on, nor is it something I talked about today, but that made that work possible as well. Finally, I'd like to thank you for being so patient with me tonight, and that's all, folks.
Your lecture. You discussed in the medical applications of porphyrins, I guess the potential for porphyrins to be a contrast agent in MRI.
Right.
And I'm wondering, is that something, obviously there would be benefits of replacing a radioactive material, right?
Magnetic resonance imaging, which is a contrast agent, essentially it uses the same idea as NMR spectroscopy. And basically, you put the patient inside a big magnetic field and you make measurements. The measurements are based on water. And the contrast agent basically affects how the water molecules behave. They don't use radioactive elements for this, but commonly they use a lanthanide called gadolinium. Gadolinium is very toxic. Now, so what's been done, they're not really porphyrins they're using, but molecules that are similar to porphyrins, but they're a bit bigger. And they can bind gadolinium. And so it's gadolinium compounds which are used in the MRI process. And certainly, that's more in the developmental stage than it is in reality at this point. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of things like that. The biggest one that's been looked at with porphyrins is photodynamic therapy. And that method, basically the porphyrin absorbs light, and that excites it. Basically it goes to a higher energy, and it transfers energy to oxygen. And you form reactive oxygen species from it, such as singlet oxygen. Singlet oxygen is one of the most toxic materials there are. But if you form it in the tumour cell, the only place it does any damage is in the tumour. And so, that's the basis for that sort of technique. That wasn't your question, but there are a number of other potential things out there. Anything else? Yeah?
When you were talking about aromaticity in your compound, right, prior to the heavy metal chelation, was not planar. Were you saying that at that point it was still aromatic but not planar, or only after the chelation?
No. So even though the compounds are sometimes not at all planar, they are aromatic. When you put the silver in, the silver actually ties it flat. And it probably is more aromatic because of that. We've actually lost part of the probe though, because we need to have a hydrogen on the inside to make some of the measurements. And there is no hydrogen left, we have a silver instead. But no, they're both aromatic, so the silver made it more plain. Probably didn't make that clear. Any more? Yeah.
I'm sure I've been told, but I can't remember. How did you get involved in porphyrins in the first place?
That's a good question. When I was very young, once I finished my undergraduate work at Exeter, I looked around for something to do, and I went on for a PhD. I went to the University of Wales, which is where they filmed Doctor Who. it's in Cardiff, which is where they do that. And the guy I worked with was a porphyrin chemist. And time is very well known. He also worked with Indoles and other Korean compounds. But he was looking at natural porphyrin. And I was sucked into that. I did a postdoc on something completely different. But when I could do independent research, I went back to porphyrin. And of course, you want to do something different, but based on something you know about. So I learned a lot about porphyrin. I didn't want to do what I'd been doing in Cardiff. I wanted to find my own spin on it. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 29.5 years at the Illinois State University, is putting my own spin on porphyrin. So it's like most things. I mean, how did you get into laboratory chemistry? I assume you worked for the laboratory chemistry. There you are.
I want to thank you for that. Thank you all for coming as well. You know, at the beginning, one of the things that I said during the introduction was that, excuse me, one of the goals of this lecture series is to fulfill our social obligation to the community in which we find ourselves and to take our work outside the walls of the university. And I believe it's our obligation to make clear to the world what it is that we do and why they should think it's important. And I really want to thank Professor Lash for being an excellent realization of that goal. So thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And it's my pleasure to present you with this medallion as recognition of your designation as the latest distinguished lecturer of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Thank you very much.
I believe there are some other former distinguished lecturers here. If there are any, could you stand and be recognized? So thank you all once again for being with us, and I hope you'll stay around for a while to join us for refreshments and conversation. Thanks very much for coming.